gave up the battle and fled when we came, crying out that the king of the dead was upon them. Only Angbor, lord of Lamadon, had the heart to abide us, and Aragorn bade him gather his folk and come behind, if they dared, when the grey host had passed. "At Pelargir the heir of Isildur will have need of you," he said. Thus we crossed over Gilrine, driving the allies of Mordor in rout before us, and then we rested a while. But soon Aragorn arose, saying, "Lo, already Minas Tirith is assailed. I fear that it will fall ere we come to its aid." So we mounted again before night had passed, and went on with all the speed that our horses could endure over the plains of Lebenin. Legolas paused and sighed, and turning his eyes southward, softly he sang,
"Silver flow the streams from Kelos to Erwy, in the green fields of Lebenin. Tall grows the grass there in the wind from the sea, the white lilies sway. And the golden bells are shaken of Marlos and Alfirin, in the green fields of Lebanon, in the wind from the sea."
Green are those fields in the songs of my people, but they were dark then, grey wastes in the blackness before us, and over the wide land, trampling unheeded the grass and the flowers, we hunted our foes through a day and a night, until we came at the bitter end to the great river at last. Then I thought in my heart that we drew near to the sea, for wide was the water in the darkness, and sea-birds innumerable cried on its shores. Alas for the wailing of the gulls! Did not the lady tell me to beware of them? Now I cannot forget them.
"For my part I heeded them not," said Gimli, "for we came then at last upon battle in earnest. There at Pelargir lay the main fleet of Umbar, 50 great ships and smaller vessels beyond count. Many of those that we pursued had reached the havens before us, and brought their fear with them, and some of the ships had put off, seeking to escape down the river or to reach the far shore, and many of the smaller craft were ablaze. But the Haradrim, being now driven to the rink, turned at bay, and they were fierce in despair, and they laughed when they looked on us, for they were a great army still. But Aragorn halted and cried with a great voice, 'Now come, by the Blackstone I call you.' And suddenly the shadow host that had hung back at the last came up like a grey tide, sweeping all away before it. Faint cries I heard, and dim horns blowing, and a murmur as of countless far voices. It was like the echo of some forgotten battle in the dark years long ago. Pale swords were drawn, but I know not whether their blades would still bite, for the dead needed no longer any weapon but fear. None would withstand them. To every ship they came that was drawn up, and then they passed over the water to those that were anchored, and all the mariners were filled with the madness of terror and leapt overboard, save the slaves chained to the oars. Reckless we rowed among our fleeing foes, driving them like leaves, until we came to the shore. And then to each of the great ships that remained, Aragorn sent one of the Dúnedain, and they comforted the captives that were aboard, and bade them put aside fear and be free. Ere that dark day ended, none of the enemy were left to resist us. All were drowned, or were flying south in the hope to find their own lands upon foot. Strange and wonderful, I thought it, that the designs of Mordor should be overthrown by such wraiths of fear and darkness. With its own weapons was it worsted."
"Strange indeed," said Legolas. "In that hour I looked on Aragorn and thought how great and terrible a lord he might have become in the strength of his will had he taken the ring to himself. Not for naught does Mordor fear him, but nobler is his spirit than the understanding of Sauron. For is he not of the children of Lúthien? Never shall that line fail, though the years may lengthen beyond count."
"Beyond the eyes of the dwarves are such foretellings," said Gimli. "But mighty indeed was Aragorn that day. No, All the black fleet was in his hands, and he chose the greatest ship to be his own, and he went up into it. Then he let sound a great concourse of trumpets taken from the enemy, and the shadow host withdrew to the shore. There they stood silent, hardly to be seen, save for a red gleam in their eyes that caught the glare of the ships that were burning. And Aragorn spoke in a loud voice to the dead men, crying, "Hear now the words of the heir of Isildur. Your oath is fulfilled. Go back and trouble not the valleys ever again. Depart and be at rest." And thereupon the king of the dead stood out before the host and broke his spear and cast it down. Then he bowed low and turned away, and swiftly the whole grey host drew off and vanished like a mist that is driven back by a sudden wind, and it seemed to me that I awoke from a dream. That night we rested while others laboured, for there were many captives set free, and many slaves released who had been folk of Gondor taken in raids, and soon also there was a great gathering of men out of Lebenin and the Aethir, and Angbor of Lamadon came up, with all the horsemen that he could muster. Now that the fear of the dead was removed, they came to aid us and to look on the heir of Isildur, for the rumour of that name had run like fire in the dark. And that is near the end of our tale. For during that evening and night many ships were made ready and manned, and in the morning the fleet set forth. Long past, it now seems, yet it was but the morn of the day yesterday, the sixth since we rode from Dunharrow. But still Aragorn was driven by fear that time was too short. "It is 40 leagues and 2 from Pelagia to the landings of the Harland," he said. "Yet to the Harland we must come to-morrow or fail utterly." The oars were now wielded by free men, and manfully they laboured. Yet slowly we passed up the great river, for we strove against its stream, and though that is not swift down in the south, we had no help of wind. Heavy would my heart have been, for all our victory at the havens, if Legolas had not laughed suddenly. "Up with your beard, Durin, son," he said, "for thus is it spoken, oft hope is born when all is forlorn." But what hope he saw from afar he wouldn't tell. When night came it did but deepen the darkness, and our hearts were hot. For away in the north we saw a red glow under the cloud, and Aragorn said, "Minas Tirith is burning." But at midnight hope was indeed born anew. Sea-crafty men of the Aethir, gazing southward, spoke of a change coming with a fresh wind from the sea. Long ere day the masted ships hoisted sail, and our speed grew until dawn whitened the foam of our prows. And so it was, as you know, that we came in the third hour of the morning with a fair wind and the sun unveiled, and we unfurled the great standard in battle. It was a great day and a great hour, whatever may come after.
"Follow what may, great deeds are not lessened in worth," said Legolas. "Great deed was the riding of the paths of the dead, and great it shall remain, though none be left in Gondor to sing of it in the days that are to come."
"And that may well befall," said Gimli, "for the faces of Aragorn and Gandalf are grave. Much I wonder what counsels they are taking in the tents there below. For my part, like Merry, I wish that with our victory the war was now over. Yet whatever is still to do, I hope to have a part in it, for the honour of the folk of the Lonely Mountain."
"And I for the folk of the Great Wood," said Legolas, "and for the love of the Lord of the White Tree." Then the companions fell silent, but a while they sat there in the high place, each busy with his own thoughts, while the captains debated. When the Prince Imrahil had parted from Legolas and Gimli, at once he set for Eomer. And he went down with him from the city, and they came to the tents of Aragorn that were set up on the field not far from the place where King Theoden had fallen. And there they took counsel together with Gandalf and Aragorn and the sons of Elrond.
"My lords," said Gandalf, "listen to the words of the steward of Gondor before he died. You may triumph on the fields of the Pelennor for a day, but against the power that has now arisen there is no victory. I do not bid you despair as he did, but to ponder the truth in these words. The stones of seeing do not lie, and not even the Lord of Barad-dûr can make them do so. He can, maybe, by his will, choose what things shall be seen by weaker minds, or cause them to mistake the meaning of what they see. Nonetheless, it cannot be doubted that when Denethor saw great forces arrayed against him in Mordor, and more still being gathered, he saw that which truly is. Hardly has our strength sufficed to beat off the first great assault. The next will be greater. This war, then, is without final hope, as Denethor perceived. Victory cannot be achieved by arms, whether you sit here to endure siege after siege, or march out to be overwhelmed beyond the river. You have only a choice of evils, and prudence would counsel you to strengthen such strong places as you have, and there await the onset, for so shall the time before your end be made a little longer. Then you would have us retreat to Minas Tirith, or Dol Amroth, or to Dun Harrow, and there sit like children on sand castles when the tide is flowing? Said Imrahil. That would be no new counsel, said Gandalf. Have you not done this and little more in all the days of Denethor? But no, I said this would be prudent. I do not counsel prudence. I said victory could not be achieved by arms. I still hope for victory, but not by arms. For into the midst of all these policies comes the ring of power, the foundation of Barad-dûr, and the hope of Sauron. Concerning this thing, my lords, you now all know enough for the understanding of our plight, and of Sauron's. If he regains it, your valour is vain, and his victory will be swift and complete, so complete that none can foresee the end of it while this world lasts. If it is destroyed, then he'll fall, and his fall will be so low that none can foresee his arising ever again. For he will lose the best part of the strength that was native to him in his beginning, and all that was made or begun with that power will crumble, and he will be maimed forever, becoming a mere spirit of malice that gnaws itself in the shadows, but cannot again grow or take shape. And so a great evil of this world will be removed. Other evils there are that may come, for Sauron is himself but a servant or emissary. Yet it is not our part to muster all the tides of the world, but to do what is in us for the succour of those years wherein we are set, uprooting the evil in the fields that we know, so that those who live after may have clean earth to till. What weather they shall have is not ours to rule. Now Sauron knows all this, and he knows that this precious thing which he lost has been found again. But he does not yet know where it is, or so we hope. And therefore he is now in great doubt. For if we have found this thing, there are some among us with strength enough to wield it. That too he knows. For do I not guess rightly, Aragorn, that you have shown yourself to him in the stone of Orthonk?
I did so ere I rode from the Hornburg, answered Aragorn. I deemed that the time was ripe, and that the stone had come to me for just such a purpose. It was then 10 days since the ring-bearer went east from Rauros, and the eye of Sauron, I thought, should be drawn out from his own land. Too seldom has he been challenged since he returned to his tower. Though if I had foreseen how swift would be his onset in answer, maybe I should not have dared to show myself. Bare time was given me to come to your aid. But how is this? Said Éomer. All is vain, you say, if he has the ring. Why should he think it not vain to assail us, if we have it?
He is not yet sure, said Gandalf, and he has not built up his power by waiting until his enemies are secure, as we have done. Also, we could not learn how to wield the full power all in a day. Indeed, it can be used only by one master alone, not by many, and he will look for a time of strife, ere one of the great among us makes himself master and puts down the others. In that time, the ring might aid him, if he were certain. He is watching. He sees much and hears much.
His Nazgul are still abroad. They passed over this field ere the sunrise, though few of the weary and sleeping were aware of them. He studies the signs. The sword that robbed him of his treasure remade, the winds of fortune turning in our favour, and the defeat unlooked for of his first assault, the fall of his great captain. His doubt will be growing, even as we speak here. His eye is now straining towards us, blind almost to all else that is moving. So we must keep it. Therein lies all our hope. This, then, is my counsel. We have not the ring. In wisdom or great folly it has been sent away to be destroyed, lest it destroy us. Without it, we cannot by force defeat his force. But we must at all costs keep his eye from his true peril. We cannot achieve victory by arms, but by arms we can give the ring-bearer his only chance, frail though it may be. As Aragorn has begun, so we must go on. We must push Sauron to his last throw. We must call out his hidden strength, so that he shall empty his land. We must march out to meet him at once. We must make ourselves the bait, though his jaws should close on us. He will take that bait, in hope and in greed, for he will think that in such rashness he sees the pride of the new ring-lord, and he will say, "So, he pushes out his neck too soon and too far. Let him come on, and behold, I will have him in a trap from which he cannot escape. There I will crush him, and what he has taken in his insolence shall be mine again for ever." We must walk open-eyed into that trap with courage, but small hope for ourselves. For, my lords, it may well prove that we ourselves shall perish utterly in a black battle far from the living lands, so that even if Barad-dûr be thrown down, we shall not live to see a new age. But this, I deem, is our duty. And better so than to perish nonetheless, as we surely shall, if we sit here and know as we die that no new age shall be. They were silent for a while. At length Aragorn spoke. "As I have begun, so I will go on. We come now to the very brink, where hope and despair are akin. To waver is to fall. Let none now reject the counsels of Gandalf, whose long labours against Sauron come at last to their test. But for him, all would long ago have been lost. Nonetheless, I don't yet claim to command any man. Let others choose as they will." Then said Elro here, "From the north we came with this purpose, and from Elrond our father we brought this very counsel. We will not turn back." "As for myself," said Éomer, "I've little knowledge of these deep matters, but I need it not. This I know, and it's enough, that as my friend Aragorn succoured me and my people, so I'll aid him when he calls. I will go."
"As for me," said Imrahil, "the Lord Aragorn I hold to be my liege lord, whether he claim it or no. His wish is to me a command. I will go also. Yet for a while I stand in the place of the steward of Gondor, and it is mine to think first of its people. To prudence some heed must still be given. For we must prepare against all chances, good as well as evil. Now it may be that we shall triumph, and while there is any hope of this, Gondor must be protected. I would not have us return with victory to a city in ruins and a land ravaged behind us. And yet we learn from the Rohirrim that there is an army still unfought upon our northern flank."
"That is true," said Gandalf. "I do not counsel you to leave the city all unmanned. Indeed, the force that we lead east need not be great enough for any assault in earnest upon Mordor, so long as it be great enough to challenge battle. And it must move soon. Therefore I ask the captains, what force could we muster and lead out in 2 days' time at the latest? And they must be hardy men that go willingly, knowing their peril."
"All are weary, and very many have wounds light or grievous," said Éomer. "And we've suffered much loss of our horses, and that is ill to bear."
If we must ride soon, then I cannot hope to lead even 2,000s, and yet leave as many for the defence of the city.
We have not only to reckon with those who fought on this field, said Aragorn. New strength is on the way from the southern fiefs, now that the coasts have been rid. 4,000s I sent marching from Pelagia through Lossarnoch 2 days ago, and Angbor the Fearless rides before them. If we set out in 2 days more, they will draw nigh ere we depart. Moreover, many were bidden to follow me up the river in any craft they could gather, and with this wind they will soon be at hand. Indeed, several ships have already come to the Harland. I judge that we could lead out 7,000s of horse and foot, and yet leave the city in better defence than it was when the assault began.
The gate is destroyed, said Imrahil. And where now is the skill to rebuild it and set it up anew?
In Erebor, in the kingdom of Dain, there is such skill, said Aragorn. And if all our hopes don't perish, then in time I'll send Gimli, Gloin's son, to ask for rights of the mountain. But men are better than gates, and no gate will endure against our enemy if men desert it. This, then, was the end of the debate of the lords, that they should set forth on the second morning from that day with 7,000s, if these might be found, and the great part of this force should be on foot, because of the evil lands into which they would go. Aragorn should find some 2,000s of those that he had gathered to him in the south, but Imrahil should find 3,500s, and Eomer find hundreds of the Rohirrim who were unhorsed but themselves war-worthy, and he himself should lead 500s of his best riders on horse. And another company of 500 horse there should be, among which should ride the sons of Elrond with the Dúnedain and the knights of Dol Amroth. All told, 6,000 foot and 1,000 horse. But the main strength of the Rohirrim that remained horsed and able to fight, some 3,000 under the command of Elfhelm, should waylay the west road against the enemy that was in Anorion. And at once swift riders were sent out to gather what news they could northwards, and eastwards from Osgiliath and the road to Minas Morgul. And when they had reckoned up all their strength and taken thought for the journeys they should make and the roads they should choose, Imrahil suddenly laughed aloud.
"Surely," he cried, "this is the greatest jest in all the history of Gondor, that we should ride with 7,000s, scarce as many as the vanguard of its army in the days of its power, to assail the mountains and the impenetrable gate of the Black Land. So might a child threaten a mail-clad knight with a bow of string and green willow. If the Dark Lord knows so much as you say, Mithrandir, will he not rather smile than fear, and with his little finger crush us like a fly that tries to sting him? No, he will try to trap the fly and take the sting," said Gandalf. "And there are names among us that are worth more than 1,000 mail-clad knights apiece. No, he will not smile." "Neither shall we," said Aragorn. "If this be jest, then it is too bitter for laughter. Nay, it is the last move in a great jeopardy, and for one side or the other it will bring the end of the game." Then he drew Andúril, and held it up glittering in the sun. "You shall not be sheathed again until the last battle is fought," he said.
Chapter 10. The Black Gate Opens. 2 days later the army of the west was all assembled on the Pelennor. The host of orcs and easterlings had turned back out of Anorion, but harried and scattered by the Rohirrim, they had broken and fled with little fighting towards Caer Andros. And with that threat destroyed and new strength arriving out of the south, the city was as well manned as might be. Scouts reported that no enemies remained upon the roads east as far as the crossroads of the fallen king. All now was ready for the last throw. Legolas and Gimli were to ride again together in the company of Aragorn and Gandalf, who went in the van with the Dúnedain and the sons of Elrond. But Merry, to his shame, was not to go with them.
"You're not fit for such a journey," said Aragorn. "But don't be ashamed.
If you do no more in this war, you have already earned great honour. Peregrine shall go and represent the Shire folk, and do not grudge him his chance of peril, for though he has done as well as his fortune allowed him, he has yet to match your deed. But in truth, all now are in like danger. Though it may be our part to find a bitter end before the gate of Mordor, if we do so, then you will come also to a last stand, either here or wherever the black tide overtakes you. Farewell.
And so despondently Merinau stood and watched the mustering of the army. Bergil was with him, and he also was downcast, for his father was to march leading a company of the men of the city. He could not rejoin the guard until his case was judged. In that same company Pippin was also to go, as a soldier of Gondor. Merry could see him not far off, a small but upright figure among the tall men of Minas Tirith. At last the trumpets rang and the army began to move. Troop by troop and company by company, they wheeled and went off eastward. And long after they had passed away out of sight down the great road to the causeway, Merry stood there. The last glint of the morning sun on spear and helm twinkled and was lost, and still he remained with bowed head and heavy heart, feeling friendless and alone. Every one that he cared for had gone away into the gloom that hung over the distant eastern sky, and little hope at all was left in his heart that he would ever see any of them again. As if recalled by his mood of despair, the pain in his arm returned, and he felt weak and old, and the sunlight seemed thin. He was roused by the touch of Bergil's hand. "Come, Master Perian," said the lad. "You are still in pain, I see. I will help you back to the healers. But don't fear. They'll come back. The men of Minas Tirith will never be overcome. And now they have the Lord Elfstone, and Beregond of the Guard, too." Ere noon the army came to Osgiliath. There all the workers and craftsmen that could be spared were busy. Some were strengthening the ferries and boat-bridges that the enemy had made, and in part destroyed when they fled. Some gathered stores and booty, and others on the eastern side across the river were throwing up hasty works of defence. The vanguard passed on through the ruins of old Gondor, and over the wide river, and on up the long straight road that in the high days had been made to run from the fair Tower of the Sun to the tall Tower of the Moon, which now was Minas Morgul in its accursed vale. 5 miles beyond Osgiliath they halted, ending their first day's march. But the horsemen pressed on, and ere evening they came to the crossroads and the great ring of trees, and all was silent. No sign of any enemy had they seen, no cry or call had been heard, no shaft had sped from rock or thicket by the way, yet ever as they went forward they felt the watchfulness of the land increase. Tree and stone, blade and leaf were listening. The darkness had been dispelled, and far away westward sunset was on the Vale of Anduin, and the white peaks of the mountains blushed in the blue air, but a shadow and a gloom brooded upon the Efel Duath. Then Aragorn set trumpeters at each of the four roads that ran into the ring of trees, and they blew a great fanfare, and the heralds cried aloud, "The lords of Gondor have returned, and all this land that is theirs they take back." The hideous orc head that was set upon the carven figure was cast down and broken in pieces, and the old king's head was raised and set in its place once more, still crowned with white and golden flowers. And men laboured to wash and pare away all the foul scrawls that orcs had put upon the stone. Now in their debate some had counselled that Minas Morgul should first be assailed, and if they might take it, it should be utterly destroyed. "And maybe," said Imrahil, "the road that leads thence to the pass above will prove an easier way of assault upon the Dark Lord than his northern gate." But against this Gandalf had spoken urgently, because of the evil that dwelt in the valley, where the minds of living men were turned to madness and horror, and because also of the news that Faramir had brought. For if the Ring-bearer had indeed attempted that way, then above all they should not draw the eye of Mordor thither. So the next day, when the main host came up, They set a strong guard upon the crossroads to make some defence, if Mordor should send a force over the Morgul Pass, or should bring more men up from the south. For that guard they chose mostly archers who knew the ways of Ithilien, and would lie hid in the woods and slopes about the meeting of the ways. But Gandalf and Aragorn rode with the vanguard to the entrance of Morgul Vale, and looked on the evil city. It was dark and lifeless, but the orcs and lesser creatures of Mordor that had dwelt there had been destroyed in battle, and the Nazgul were abroad. Yet the air of the valley was heavy with fear and enmity. Then they broke the evil bridge, and set red flames in the noisome fields, and departed. The day after, being the third day since they set out from Minas Tirith, the army began its northward march along the road. It was some 100 miles by that way from the crossroads to the Morannon, and what might befall them before they came, so far none knew. They went openly, but heedfully, with mounted scouts before them on the road, and others on foot upon either side, especially on the eastward flank. For there lay dark thickets, and a tumbled land of rocky gills and crags, behind which the long grim slopes of the Efel Duath clambered up. The weather of the world remained fair, and the wind held in the west, but nothing could waft away the glooms and the sad mists that clung about the mountains of shadow. And behind them at whiles great smokes would arise and hover in the upper winds. Ever and anon Gandalf let blow the trumpets, and the heralds would cry, "The lords of Gondor are come! Let all leave this land or yield them up!" But Imrahil said, "Say not the lords of Gondor, say the king Elessar. For that is true, even though he has not yet sat upon the throne, and it will give the enemy more thought if the heralds use the name." And thereafter, thrice a day, the heralds proclaimed the coming of the king Elessar, but none answered the challenge. Nonetheless, though they marched in seeming peace, the hearts of all the army, from the highest to the lowest, were downcast, and with every mile that they went north, foreboding of evil grew heavier on them. It was near the end of the second day of their march before the crossroads that they first met any offer of battle. For a strong force of orcs and easterlings attempted to take their leading companies in an ambush, and that was in the very place where Faramir had waylaid the men of Harad, and the road went in a deep cutting through an outthrust of the eastward hills. But the captains of the west were well warned by their scouts, skilled men from Heneth Arnon, led by Mablung, and so the ambush was itself trapped. For horsemen went wide about the westward and came up on the flank of the enemy and from behind, and they were destroyed or driven east into the hills. But the victory did little to enhearten the captains. "It is but a feint," said Aragorn, "and its chief purpose, I deem, was rather to draw us on by a false guess of our enemy's weakness than to do us much hurt yet." And from that evening onward the Nazgul came and followed every move of the army. They still flew high and out of sight of all save Legolas, and yet their presence could be felt as a deepening of shadow and a dimming of the sun. And though the ringwraiths did not yet stoop low upon their foes and were silent, uttering no cry, the dread of them could not be shaken off. So time and the hopeless journey wore away. Upon the fourth day from the crossroads and the sixth from Minas Tirith, they came at last to the end of the living lands, and began to pass into the desolation that lay before the gates of the pass of Kirith Gorgor. And they could descry the marshes and the desert that stretched north and west to the Emin Weald. So desolate were those places, and so deep the horror that lay on them, that some of the host were unmanned, and they could neither walk nor ride further north. Aragorn looked at them, and there was pity in his eyes rather than wrath, for these were young men from Rohan, from Westfold far away, or husbandmen from Lossarnach, and to them Mordor had been, from childhood, a name of evil and yet unreal, a legend that had no part in their simple life. And now they walked like men in a hideous dream made true, and they understood not this war, nor why fate should lead them to such a pass.
Go, said Aragorn, but keep what honour you may, and do not run. And there is a task which you may attempt, and so be not wholly shamed. Take your way southwest till you come to Caer Andros, and if that is still held by enemies, as I think, then retake it, if you can, and hold it to the last in defence of Gondor and Rohan.
Then some, being shamed by his mercy, overcame their fear and went on, and the others took new hope, hearing of a manful deed within their measure that they could turn to, and they departed.
And so, since many men had already been left at the crossroads, it was with less than 6,000 that the captains of the West came at last to challenge the Black Gate and the might of Mordor. They advanced now slowly, expecting at every hour some answer to their challenge, and they drew together, since it was but waste of men to send out scouts or small parties from the main host. At nightfall of the fifth day of the march from Morgul Vale, they made their last camp, and set fires about it of such dead wood and heath as they could find. They passed the hours of night in wakefulness, and they were aware of many things half seen that walked and prowled all about them, and they heard the howling of wolves. The wind had died, and all the air seemed still. They could see little, for though it was cloudless, and the waxing moon was 4 nights old, there were smokes and fumes that rose out of the earth, and the white crescent was shrouded in the mists of Mordor. It grew cold. As morning came, the wind began to stir again, but now it came from the north, and soon it freshened to a rising breeze. All the night walkers were gone, and the land seemed empty. North amid their noisome pits lay the first of the great heaps and hills of slag and broken rock and blasted earth, the vomit of the maggot folk of Mordor. But south and now near loomed the great rampart of Kirith Gorgor, and the Black Gate amidmost, and the two towers of the Teeth, tall and dark upon either side. For in their last march the captains had turned away from the old road as it bent east, and avoided the peril of the lurking hills, and so now they were approaching the Morannon from the northwest, even as Frodo had done. The two vast iron doors of the Black Gate under its frowning arch were fast closed. Upon the battlement nothing could be seen. All was silent but watchful. They were come to the last end of their folly, and stood forlorn and chill in the grey light of early day before towers and walls which their army could not assault with hope, not even if it had brought thither engines of great power, and the enemy had no more force than would suffice for the manning of the gate and wall alone. Yet they knew that all the hills and rocks about the Morannon were filled with hidden foes, and the shadowy defile beyond was bored and tunnelled by teeming broods of evil things. And as they stood, they saw all the Nazgûl gathered together, hovering above the towers of the Teeth like vultures, and they knew that they were watched, but still the enemy made no sign. No choice was left them but to play their part to its end. Therefore Aragorn now set the host in such array as could best be contrived, and they were drawn up on two great hills of blasted stone and earth that orcs had piled in years of labour. Before them, towards Mordor, lay like a moat a great mire of reeking mud and foul-smelling pools. When all was ordered, the captains rode forth towards the Black Gate with a great guard of horsemen and the banner and heralds and trumpeters. There was Gandalf as chief herald, and Aragorn with the sons of Elrond, and Éomer of Rohan and Imrahil, and Legolas and Gimli and Peregrin were bidden to go also, so that all the enemies of Mordor should have a witness. They came within cry of the Morannon, and unfurled the banner, and blew upon their trumpets, and the heralds stood out and sent their voices up over the battlement of Mordor. "Come forth," they cried, "let the Lord of the Black Land come forth. Justice shall be done upon him, for wrongfully he has made war upon Gondor and wrested its lands. Therefore the king of Gondor demands that he should atone for his evils, and depart then for ever. Come forth!
There was a long silence, and from wall and gate no cry or sound was heard in answer. But Sauron had already laid his plans, and he had a mind first to play these mice cruelly before he struck to kill. So it was that, even as the captains were about to turn away, the silence was broken suddenly. There came a long rolling of great drums like thunder in the mountains, and then a braying of horns that shook the very stones and stunned men's ears. And there upon the middle door of the black gate was thrown open with a great clang, and out of it there came an embassy from the Dark Tower. At its head there rode a tall and evil shape, mounted upon a black horse, if horse it was, for it was huge and hideous, and its face was a frightful mask, more like a skull than a living head, and in the sockets of its eyes and in its nostrils there burned a flame. The rider was robed all in black, and black was his lofty helm, yet this was no ringwraith but a living man. The lieutenant of the Tower of Barad-dûr he was, and his name is remembered in no tale, for he himself had forgotten it, and he said,
"I am the Mouth of Sauron."
But it is told that he was a renegade, who came out of the race of those that are named the Black Númenóreans, for they established their dwellings in Middle-earth during the years of Sauron's domination, and they worshipped him, being enamoured of evil knowledge. And he entered the service of the Dark Tower when it first rose again, and because of his cunning he grew ever higher in the Lord's favour, and he learned great sorcery, and knew much of the mind of Sauron, and he was more cruel than any orc. He it was that now rode out, and with him came only a small company of black-harnessed soldiery, and a single banner, black but bearing on it in red the evil eye. Now halting a few paces before the captains of the West, he looked them up and down and laughed.
"Is there any one in this rout with authority to treat with me?" he asked. "Or indeed with wit to understand me? Not thou, at least," he mocked, turning to Aragorn with scorn. "It needs more to make a king than a piece of elvish glass, or a rabble such as this. Why, any brigand of the hills can show as good a following." Aragorn said naught in answer, but he took the other's eye and held it, and for a moment they strove thus. But soon, though Aragorn did not stir nor move hand to weapon, the other quailed and gave back as if menaced with a blow.
"I am a herald and ambassador, and may not be assailed," he cried.
"Where such laws hold," said Gandalf, "it is also the custom for ambassadors to use less insolence. But no one has threatened you. You have naught to fear from us, until your errand is done. But unless your master has come to new wisdom, then with all his servants you will be in great peril."
"So," said the messenger, "then thou art the spokesman, old Greybeard. Have we not heard of thee at whiles, and of thy wanderings, ever hatching plots and mischief at a safe distance? But this time thou hast stuck out thy nose too far, Master Gandalf, and thou shalt see what comes to him who sets his foolish webs before the feet of Sauron the Great. I have tokens that I was bidden to show to thee in especial, if thou shouldst dare to come."
He signed to one of his guards, and he came forward bearing a bundle swathed in black cloths. The messenger put these aside, and there, to the wonder and dismay of all the captains, he held up first the short sword that Sam had carried, and next a great cloak with an elven brooch, and last the coat of mithril mail that Frodo had worn wrapped in his tattered garments. A blackness came before their eyes, and it seemed to them in a moment of silence that the world stood still, but their hearts were dead and their last hope gone. Pippin, who stood behind Prince Imrahil, sprang forward with a cry of grief.
"Silence,"
said Gandalf sternly, thrusting him back, but the messenger laughed aloud.
"So you have yet another of these imps with you," he cried. What use you find in them I cannot guess, but to send them as spies into Mordor is beyond even your accustomed folly. Still, I thank him, for it is plain that this brat at least has seen these tokens before, and it would be vain for you to deny them now. I do not wish to deny them, said Gandalf. Indeed, I know them all, and all their history, and despite your scorn, foul mouth of Sauron, you cannot say as much. But why do you bring them here?
Dwarf coat, elf coat, blade of the downfallen west, and spy from the little ratland of the Shire. Nay, do not start.
We know it well. Here are the marks of a conspiracy. Now, maybe he that bore these things was a creature that you would not grieve to lose, and maybe otherwise. One dear to you, perhaps? If so, take swift counsel with what little wit is left to you. For Sauron does not love spies, and what his fate shall be depends now on your choice.
No one answered him, but he saw their faces grey with fear and the horror in their eyes, and he laughed again, for it seemed to him that his sport went well.
Good, good, he said. He was dear to you, I see.
Or else his errand was one that you did not wish to fail.
It has. And now he shall endure the slow torment of years, as long and slow as our arch in the great tower can contrive, and never be released, unless maybe when he is changed and broken, so that he may come to you, and you shall see what you have done.
This shall surely be, unless you accept my lord's terms.
Name the terms, said Gandalf steadily. But those nearby saw the anguish in his face, and now he seemed an old and wizened man, crushed, defeated at last. They did not doubt that he would accept.
These are the terms, said the messenger,
and smiled as he eyed them one by one.
The rabble of Gondor and its deluded allies shall withdraw at once beyond the Anduin, first taking oaths never again to assail Sauron the Great in arms, open or secret. All lands east of Anduin shall be Sauron's forever, solely.
West of the Anduin, as far as the Misty Mountains and the Gap of Rohan, shall be tributary to Mordor, and men there shall bear no weapons, but shall have leave to govern their own affairs. But they shall help to rebuild Isengard, which they have wantonly destroyed, and that shall be Sauron's, and there his lieutenant shall dwell, not Saruman, but one more worthy of trust.
Looking in the messenger's eyes, they read his thought. He was to be that lieutenant, and gather all that remained of the West under his sway. He would be their tyrant, and they his slaves. But Gandalf said,
"This is much to demand for the delivery of one servant, that your master should receive in exchange what he must else fight many a war to gain? Or has the field of Gondor destroyed his open war, so that he falls to Hagding? And if indeed we rated this prisoner so high, what surety have we that Sauron, the base master of treachery, will keep his part? Where is this prisoner? Let him be brought forth and yielded to us, and then we will consider these demands."
It seemed then to Gandalf, intent, watching him as a man engaged in fencing with a deadly foe, that for the taking of a breath the messenger was at a loss. Yet swiftly he laughed again.
"Do not bandy words in your insolence with the mouth of Sauron," he cried. "Surety you crave. Sauron gives none. If you sue for his clemency, you must first do his bidding. These are his terms. Take them or leave them." "These we will take," said Gandalf suddenly. He cast aside his cloak, and a white light shone forth like a sword in that black place. Before his upraised hand the foul messenger recoiled, and Gandalf, coming, seized and took from him the tokens, coat, cloak, and sword. "These we will take in memory of our friend," he cried. "But as for your terms, we reject them utterly. Get you gone, for your embassy is over and death is near to you. We did not come here to waste words in treating with Sauron, faithless and accursed, still less with one of his slaves. Begone!"
Then the messenger of Mordor laughed no more. His face was twisted with amazement and anger to the likeness of some wild beast that, as it crouches on its prey, is smitten on the muzzle with a stinging rod. Rage filled him, and his mouth slavered, and shapeless sounds of fury came strangling from his throat. But he looked at the fell faces of the captains and their deadly eyes, and fear overcame his wrath. He gave a great cry, and turned, leapt upon his steed, and with his company galloped madly back to Kirith Gorgor. But as they went, his soldiers blew their horns in signal long arranged, and even before they came to the gate, Sauron sprang his trap. Drums rolled and fires leapt up. The great doors of the Black Gate swung back wide. Out of it streamed a great host as swiftly as swirling waters when a sluice is lifted. The captains mounted again and rode back, and from the host of Mordor there went up a jeering yell. Dust rose smothering the air, as from nearby there marched up an enemy of Easterlings that had waited for the signal in the shadow of Ered Lithwe beyond the further tower. Down from the hills on either side of the Morannon poured orcs innumerable. The men of the west were trapped, and soon, all about the grey mounds where they stood, forces 10 times and more than 10 times their match would ring them in a sea of enemies. Sauron had taken the proffered bait in jaws of steel. Little time was left to Aragorn for the ordering of his battle. Upon the one hill he stood with Gandalf, and there, fair and desperate, was raised the banner of the Tree and Stars. Upon the other hill, hard by, stood the banners of Rohan and Dol Amroth, White Horse and Silver Swan. And about each hill a ring was made facing all ways, bristling with spear and sword. But in the front towards Mordor, where the first bitter assault would come, there stood the sons of Elrond on the left, with Dúnedain about them, and on the right the Prince Imrahil, with the men of Dol Amroth, tall and fair, and picked men of the Tower of Guard. The wind blew, and the trumpets sang, and arrows whined. But the sun, now climbing towards the south, was veiled in the reeks of Mordor, and through a threatening haze it gleamed, remote, a sullen red, as if it were the ending of the day, or the end, maybe, of all the world of light. And out of the gathering murk the Nazgûl came with their cold voices crying words of death, and then all hope was quenched. Pippin had bowed, crushed with horror, when he heard Gandalf reject the terms and doom Frodo to the torment of the tower. But he had mastered himself, and now he stood beside Beregond in the front rank of Gondor with Imrahil's men. For it seemed best to him to die soon, and leave the bitter story of his life, since all was in ruin. "I wish Merry was here," he heard himself saying, and quick thoughts raced through his mind, even as he watched the enemy come charging to the assault. "Well, well, now at any rate I understand poor Denethor a little better. We might die together, Merry and I, and since die we must, why not? Well, as he's not here, I hope he'll find an easier end, but now I must do my best." He drew his sword and looked at it, and the intertwining shapes of red and gold, and the flowing characters of Númenor glinted like fire upon the blade. "This was made for just such an hour," he thought. "If only I could smite that foul messenger with it, then almost I should draw level with old Merry. Well, I'll smite some of this beastly brood before the end. I wish I could see cool sunlight and green grass again." Then, even as he thought these thoughts, the first assault crashed into them. The orcs, hindered by the mires that lay before the hills, halted and poured their arrows into the defending ranks. But through them there came striding up, roaring like beasts, a great company of hill-trolls out of Gorgoroth. Taller and broader than men they were, and they were clad only in close-fitting mesh of horny scales, or maybe that was their hideous hide. But they bore round bucklers huge and black, and wielded heavy hammers in their knotted hands. Reckless they sprang into the pools and waded across, bellowing as they came. Like a storm they broke upon the line of the men of Gondor, and beat upon helm and head, and arm and shield as smiths hewing the hot bending iron. At Pippin's side Beregond was stunned and overborne, and he fell.
and the great troll chief that smote him down bent over him, reaching out a clutching claw, for these fell creatures would bite the throats of those that they threw down. Then Pippin stabbed upwards, and the written blade of Westerness pierced through the hide and went deep into the vitals of the troll, and his black blood came gushing out. He toppled forward and came crashing down like a falling rock, burying those beneath him. Blackness and stench and crushing pain came upon Pippin, and his mind fell away into a great darkness. "So it ends as I guessed it would," his thought said, even as it fluttered away, and it laughed a little within him ere it fled. Almost gay it seemed to be casting off at last all doubt and care and fear. And then, even as it winged away into forgetfulness, it heard voices, and they seemed to be crying in some forgotten world far above, "The eagles are coming! The eagles are coming!" For one moment more Pippin's thought hovered. "Bilbo," it said. "But no, that came in his tail long, long ago. This is my tale, and it is ended now. Goodbye." And his thought fled far away, and his eyes saw no more.